Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. And we certainly do. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here once a week around our kitchen table here in the studios of beautiful KHOI in beautiful downtown Ames. We talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions.
Woo-hoo.
We do. Encourage you to support this fine radio station because this is community radio station. Wrap your mind around that. This is people's owned, people's supported,
yes,
and people generated
community
radio.
And we have a diversity of voices and different types of music and opinions and ongoing events in the community. Lots and lots of things going on here in Central Iowa.
Last week on this very own show, we talked to Jenny Welder about soap, and she uses a lot of natural herbs in her ventures, soaps, and she does natural dyes for yarns.
And a lot of local herbs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who knew all that stuff? Yes. And so she was telling us about all these different kind of herbs. And
also known as weeds.
Also known as weeds. But let's discuss weeds here. There's important things. She told me about something that was a calming, soothing weed or herb or something.
This is the antidote to poison ivy,
yes,
right?
She talked about a plant called jewel weed. And I'd heard the term jewel weed. I have no idea what jewel weed was.
I didn't know either.
So I did a little research, and I'm going to tell you what I found out about jewel weed. For one thing, just like most other plants, or lots of them, there are lots of
especially
names.
Especially weeds.
Lots of names for these things, and I couldn't find jewel weed listed in indexes any place except I found a book. Well, I refer to this book quite a bit, actually. Newcomb's Wildflower Guide by Lawrence Newcomb. It's well used. It's got pretty much everything in it. And jewel weed. It is in the impatience family and is also called touch me not. Yeah. Flowers about an inch long dangling from a long stalk. The flowers have an inward curled spur at the back, and the leaves are
egg-shaped. And kind of yellowish-orange, is
yeah,
that right?
Yeah, it looks like a teeny tiny little kind of orchid hanging there. That's a jewel weed. And yes, they have some little sap hanging from it. And there is a plump pod that contains the seeds of these jewel weeds. And they do. They explode when you touch them. So touch me not. That's what it's called.
Now, what was she saying, the part that was the antidote to poison ivy? Do you remember? Was it the sap from the flower?
Yeah, something like that.
It seemed like it.
I don't know.
We may be incorrect here, but
one could always refer to the last show by going to KHOIFM.org. Find our show there, and our shows are archived. So we'll have to look that up, what she used them for. Yeah.
Definitely said it's an antidote to poison ivy.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if we discussed how.
Yeah.
I mean, do you crush the leaves and rub them all over you? We'll have to get some more information. Maybe some of our listeners know.
But anyway, another one of those things like weeds. Weeds. It's not a weed if you can use it nicely, and it seems like touch me not or jewel weed is one of those things. We'll talk more about weeds later in the show, and we will have a report from our man in the field, Nick Odie. He has another farm talk segment for us. We've had a bit of rain on and off. And
a bit.
This is a bit. We had a rainy weekend. Donna, there was the lard baking contest.
Oh, what happened? Yes, the farmer's market this Saturday. I thought the lard baking contest was a great idea. I'm really enthusiastic about all of us cooking more with lard, especially since at the farmer's market there are at least two farmers selling really good, locally, not highly processed lard. That's, what's the black pig? Lucky Pig, I think is.
Lucky George.
Lucky George has lard, and they instituted a contest, as well as Remnant Hills also has good lard. And so I was quite excited about this. And I, you know, I made a lard pound cake and I trotted down there really early in the morning. And when I left the house, it wasn't raining and I was kind of optimistic. And then it starts blowing and cold and buckets of rain and hardly anyone showed up. But there were about 8 entrants to the contest. Almost all of them used it in pie crust. I think I was the only one that did not use it in a pie crust. And all of them were sweet fruit pies, some, you know, the usual rhubarb ones, hand pies, this and the crusts, I must say, lard crusts are very, very good. And there was one entry that made a savory pie that was had some shredded pork in it. That was very good as well. So there wasn't a bad thing in the lot. It was really well done. Unfortunately, the market was really drizzly, dismal, and not well attended.
But the crusts were flaky despite the
weather.
That's
right. Yes, that's right. The lard bakers were undaunted.
Ha! So I've been spending time in my kitchen in the rain. So in the kitchen this weekend, I did some rhubarb orange jam. What do you have going on in the kitchen?
Oh, I did a really interesting rhubarb recipe. It's from the New York Times. You can Google it by going rhubarb tagine. That's T-A-G-I-N-E. And what it is, basically, a tagine is a Moroccan recipe, traditionally made with preserved lemon. Now, preserved lemon is not something that we all keep in our kitchens around here. We're in a different culture. But the recipe, which was by Martha Rose Schulman, she's lived in France a long time. She is an American. She wrote some of the very first kind of natural whole foods cookbooks. She's a good cookbook writer. So she decided that she was going to take this Moroccan chicken recipe, which is traditionally made with preserved lemon and green olives, and she was going to convert it to use rhubarb instead. And I thought it was pretty successful. So basically you saute the chicken, then you take it out and you do a bunch of onions and leeks and I've forgotten what else is in the recipe. And then you put it back in and it has turmeric, paprika, and cinnamon in it, right? And first you pre-cook the rhubarb in rather large chunks with a lot of syrup. So I have leftover rhubarb syrup as well. But then you cook the chicken down with the olives in it. And then at the end, you add back in the rhubarb and some chopped fresh parsley. And it's quite a good recipe. So that is in the cooking.newyorktimes. And it is called a rhubarb tagine, T-A-G-I-N-E. And I have to say, it was yum.
That's a good thing to happen in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Thank you, Donna. Good, good. So I've been kind of shepherding. Does one shepherd chickens? I'm shepherding chickens now.
Sort of. I would call that a fair description. I mean,
they do come in a flock. They,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have, over the past month, well, month and a half now, I'm starting over. I had a very sad demise to my old hens. A predator got in, and so we have to start from scratch, and I haven't had to do that for a long time.
Right, you had to basically rebuild the coop.
Oh, boy, things, the coop and the security had kind of gone
flat. Well, you know, those laws of entropy, they are infallible, you know. Sooner or later, the chicken coop has to be rebuilt.
So I had the pleasure of starting with new chicks again, and my goodness, I have a healthy bunch this year, about 2 dozen, and they're just peeping along.
What kind did you get?
Oh, I've got 4 or 5 different kinds.
Oh, goody.
We've got Orpingtons and
those are
astrolopes.
The
buff Orpingtons, yeah. And astrolopes.
And what color are the astrolopes? They're dark? Are they
astrolopes
black?
Are blackish.
Black, and then beige?
Yeah, and
butterscotch.
The Orpingtons are butterscotchy.
Yes.
And I always get the green egg layers, Americanas, which are not – Americanas are the traditional chicken from South America, but it has been bred to –
to be, calm down a little.
A little bit here. Yeah. And they're called Americanas. Green eggs. I love those green eggs.
Oh,
and
me
then,
too.
Then some – white ones, and I can't remember what they are, but they're, oh, some Leghorns. Yeah. I like Leghorns. And some Rhode Island Reds, because I like those too. And anyway, they're peeping around. They always, it's such a joy to see them. They're so wonderfully small. They, because it was cold yet, they started out in a little box in my greenhouse, and they just grew and grew and grew, and they get hungry. They get hungry. And speaking of weeds, well, they like to eat things. And so just in, besides the layer mash and all that kind of stuff I buy for them at the feed store, and I do always ask for organic and or non-GMO stuff. And you can get that. Ask for it. It's worth it. If you're going to be eating these chickens, I don't know, I feel like my chickens ought to have the good stuff. So that's what I feed them, well, at least when they're starting out. But I've over the years, I have noticed that they'll kind of peck at anything. And the very first things that they eat, even as teeny tiny chicks, I'd say about a week in, of course, right out of the chick box, they're not going to eat much. But they like greens. They like to peck at things. And luckily, there is something that comes up in profusion, and especially this year because it loves cool, damp weather. And I call it a weed in my garden, but my chicks absolutely love it. And believe it or not, it's called common chickweed.
Yours must not be the first chicks to eat this.
I do not think so. No, no. It's called common chickweed, and it happens in a little, kind of a little starburst, a rosette of green, teeny, teeny, tiny little green leaves coming from a central stalk, and it lays flat on the ground, pulls out of the garden pretty easily. The little white flowers appear, but I haven't seen any little white flowers yet. It spreads like crazy, so I'm sure they'll
be coming. Oh, I'm looking at the picture. I know this one. I have it in my garden, too.
Yeah, everybody's got that. Yep, it is. It's a low-spreading, branching stems. The leaf stems attached to the main stem. If you want to look close, there's little hairs on the other side. And the small white star-shaped flowers have five deeply notched petals.
But they're teeny-weeny.
Teeny-weeny-weeny. So you can pull those up, and little chicks go after that. That's the first thing they eat. I've been experimenting for years, throwing all kinds of things in there, things like grass and dandelions. They eat that now, but those first few weeks, they like something a little delicate in their palate, and the chickweed is a delicate sort of thing. Mm. Yes, yes. If you have too much of it, you just have to hoe, pull, or mulch, because it is all over the place.
But it's not nearly as aggressive as creeping
charlie. Oh, no. It's a friendly little thing. It is. And it grows and grows and grows. Also, there is a kind of a hairy, it looks like this plant, but if the leaves are hairy, it's called mouse weed or mouse ear weed. Well, so same thing. I think they would like that.
It's the same plant?
Yeah, well, no, it's a variety.
A different plant.
A variety.
The mouse ear and the chickweed. Okay.
Yeah, and the chicks really do like that.
Do the chicks eat the mouse ears too?
I haven't found any of that yet. I'm sure it'll show up. And right now, I'm pretty much just grabbing any old thing and putting it in with them. They love dandelions, of course. And
heaven knows. How'd they do with that Sweet Annie? Do they eat that?
No. Anything that's kind of strong, believe it or not.
Oh.
They have a discerning palate. The Sweet Annie, not so much there. Plantain. They love plantain.
Oh, good.
Yeah, that's good. Good place to put it. And they love to eat that up. And there is another thing they like to eat.
Actually, plantain is very nutritious, and I think it's humanly edible. I know it has an old use. Like, for example, if you scrape or bruise, you pick some plantain and kind of smash it a little and bruise it around and lay it right on the wound. It's supposed to be very beneficial.
Ah, that's what I've heard, too. Besides, can't hurt you, right? Yeah.
No.
Yeah, plantain is great stuff. Great stuff.
Yeah, it's like a first aid remedy.
And like dandelions, it's easy to pull up.
Mm-hmm.
Chickens love that sort of thing. Another thing that is rampant this time of year is bed straw. Do you know what bed straw
is? No, I don't know that one.
If you are walking in the woods and something like a big string with little widely spaced green leaves wraps around your, sticks to your socks and drags behind you, It's sticky. And it comes in long strings with little
like
whorls.
Like a yard long?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it just goes nuts. It grows in kind of shady areas, and it's full of, it's on the edge of my woods. And that is easy to pick, too, because it grows in bunches. It runs all over, grows fast. It sticks to your socks. And it's easy to pick. I kind of go in there and think that I'm picking up cotton candy, because you just kind of twirl your arm around and it all
sticks. Does
this
mean you're going out in the woods and foraging for your chickens?
I don't go far in the woods, but yes, I do.
Ha ha!
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, I like that image.
Yeah, it's okay. Take a bucket out there, kind of make a loop and see what you can get. You can fill a bucket pretty fast. Yes, you can. There's several species of bed straw. It's also called catchweed. Huh? Get that? Catchweed, huh? And, it isn't prickly to the touch, but it does have a hairy little hairs all over the place, and it sticks to you like crazy. It's found in moist woods, thickets and roadsides.
Well, boy, do we have moist woods right
and
now.
And so we've got moist woods up the kazoo here. So, yes, we do. Yes, we do. Ah, I do like keeping chickens, and I'm looking forward to eggs. They have graduated. They have graduated from the enclosure in my greenhouse, which got way too small for them. I'd open my greenhouse door, and they'd meet me at the door. They didn't want to stay in the little box anymore. So we moved them out into the newly fortified chicken house.
Woo-hoo.
And, oh, they're just really, really having a good time out there. Yes, they are.
And so are they like 6 weeks yet?
They're like five and a half, 6 weeks.
Okay.
So they're kind of into the half-grown teenager stage.
Right.
Yeah.
And we won't get eggs until they're 6 months old, right?
Probably.
More or less.
Five or six, yeah.
And okay.
Into summer. Patience.
Now, are yours already sexed, or you might have roosters?
I ordered all pullets, as in girls, but I did order four Leghorn roosters because...
Four?
I suppose that some of them aren't going to make it. I never know. Also, that gives me a chance to pick the rooster that is not going to attack me.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
The rooster, I love a rooster with a flock of hens is really, really, really good.
One rooster.
One rooster with a small flock. They crow. I've seen some of my past roosters fluffed up in front of a fox once.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And they will warn them.
They are,
they're
huh?
very one rooster is a good idea.
They boss everybody around. They shoost everybody into the chicken house when there's a hawk overhead. It's so much fun to that poor roosters have a hard life. They have to keep track of everything, and they do.
They're very busy.
Yeah, they're busy all the time. So I'll see which one of these guys gets to stick around. Yes. Yes, I do. Oh, and another thing that chickens do pretty much like everything, and I throw just about all my weeds into the chicken yard, that is kind of a nice permaculture sort of way of looking at things. Never let anything go to waste. They call it stacking functions. Not only are you weeding the garden, you are feeding the chickens. So there's two things going on at once. There's another small flowering weed that chickens really like. It's a bit more of a warmer weather thing, and it's called, and you maybe have this in your garden too, it's self-seeds, and I've got way too much of it. It's called small flower galansoga.
Could you spell galansoga?
Oh, good heavens, I could never remember even this name. Galansoga, G-A-L-I-N-S-O-G-A. Huh? It is a pesky weed that often pops up.
Small flower galansoga.
Yeah.
That's a new one to
flowers.
Me.
Yeah, and they kind of look like little lamb's quarters coming up. Little opposite pointy leaves, opposite.
But they're not edible like lamb's
quarters. No, afraid not, except for
chickens.
Again, it likes rich, moist soil. So there
you go. Exactly what we
there
have.
There we
here.
Go. So I learned to identify that one just so I could yell at it. It's just too much. I have a good book to recommend. Rodale's Successful Organic Gardening, Controlling Weeds.
Controlling Weeds.
Yeah.
A good thing to know.
Yeah. It's a soft cover book. It's got, what's nice about it, has great pictures. So a book called Controlling Weeds from Rodale's Successful Organic Gardening. I've used it for years. It's got organic ways of dealing with some of this stuff. And I'm afraid a lot of that is just hoe it, mulch it, tear it out. Yeah. Or there's cover crops, too.
I have a little report from my front yard, which is 8th and Douglas. So the city is doing some putting in some new water pipes. Mm-hmm. And right at the corner of the street, they dug down, at least 6 feet. Mm-hmm. And so I was looking in the hole yesterday going, well, you know, I never looked down that far before. Aside from a lot of tree roots, I have to say I was astounded at the depth and quality of the soil. It's black topsoil all the way down.
Even in the middle of Old Town Ames. Yep. There you go.
Yep. I guess we haven't been badly farming it. It's sitting there, and it's pretty good-looking soil.
Yeah, let's take a thought as to what's underneath our feet. Ah, now, we've been talking about things that chickens like, and there's a lot of it this year. There's something that I wish they liked, but they don't. At least mine don't. That's Creeping Charlie.
Oh, the bane of my existence.
Also called?
Ground ivy.
Ground ivy. Oh, it's a tenacious perennial.
It's unbelievable.
It's also called gill over the ground, runaway robin.
Well, it's not running away. I wish it would run away.
I know, it doesn't at all. Or ale hoof.
Ale hoof?
A-L-E hoof. That sounds very English to me for some reason. But anyway, there it is. And it just takes over yards, and it's all purpley this time of year. And yes, it's going to seed and spreading and all sorts of things.
It's ruined my lawn.
Yeah.
Now, okay, Lana and I have been discussing this because I don't like to use herbicides, which is the common way of treating this. So I am looking for, and I've reached a point where it is way beyond pulling it out by hand. I have screwed the whole thing up, as it were, in terms of my lawn. I'm sure my neighbors hate me. I'm sure they're all just despairing and hoping it doesn't cross into their lawns. And it is a massive mess. So I've been trying to figure out how to control something. Apparently tilling is not a good idea.
No, because if you till it, every little piece will turn into a new one.
Yeah, right. This is like, the Sorcerer's Apprentice or something. You chop the broom and now you've got 5 brooms. And so Lana had a solution that I might try. Do you want to describe that?
Well, first, I'll turn back to this book, mulching. First, I'll turn back to this Rodale's book called Controlling Weeds. First off, they said fertilize lawns to encourage the grass, so that helps. But for heavy infestations, and what infestations are not heavy, of Creeping Charlie, cut or mow the plants close to the ground and then cover the area with dense mulch such as cardboard, newspapers, or plastic. Now listen, for one growing season.
If I wanted to do my front lawn, I would have to cover the whole front lawn.
For a whole
which
year.
Which is not that huge, but for the whole growing season.
Yeah. Well, actually, you could do that and then maybe put some artful potted plants out there. Or, put a lawn chair on top of it. You could do that. Mulching does work. Now, I had Creeping Charlie show up in a rather large chunk at the edge of my vegetable field, and I hate that stuff once it gets in the vegetable field. So, an experiment this year. It was coming very, very early spring, and out the old tractor, till it very, very lightly, and not drag the stuff all over, just till
enough
in there.
To rough the soil up a little.
And we planted really thick buckwheat. We've used buckwheat as a cover crop for a long time. And buckwheat comes up, it does smother out, and it is allelopathic, as in it doesn't like other stuff growing with it. So it kind of fights it. And so far, so good. The buckwheat is only about a foot and a half tall now, But it will get, waist high, and it puts on beautiful flowers. We'll see. I don't see much Creeping Charlie underneath that. So you could actually maybe experiment with growing a little bit of buckwheat or maybe even a cover crop sort of thing in your yard.
And you don't mow it, right?
No, don't mow it.
This could be an interesting front yard. Well, maybe I'm going to experiment this summer on the front garden and see how it works.
Mulch,
I'm ready for drastic measures.
Mulch and or cover crop. If you have any ideas or concepts or opinions about Creeping Charlie, why don't you email us?
Well, that is not using herbicides.
Yeah, try. Or even if you like to...
It's a challenge. It's a challenge.
You can email us at khoiradio@gmail.com. Put Donalana Kitchen in the title page. You are listening to KHOI 89.1. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back to the Donalana Kitchen. We've been talking about weeds and things.
Wildflowers, as it were.
Oh, yes. All those helpful green things out there this time of year. We're going to have a little report, a field talk report. We have a man in the field now. Nick Odie of Practical Farmers of Iowa is hosting a new podcast called On Farm, and he takes bits and pieces of that and gives us a little field talk, conversations with practical farmers. He interviews a different farmer each week, and he has a snippet of his last week's podcast, and we're going to listen to it now. He's going to talk to a young farmer called T.D. Holub.
This week on the show, we have T.D. Holub of Garden Oasis Farm in eastern Iowa. T.D. and his fiancée, Sarah, grow fruits and vegetables for a CSA and for farmers markets in Independence, Iowa City, and Cedar Rapids, and they also sell to some restaurants and New Pioneer Co-op in southeast Iowa. T.D. grew up on a traditional corn, soybean, hogs, and cattle farm and came back after college to grow vegetables. On June 9th, he'll be hosting a field day focused on the tools and machinery necessary for running a vegetable farm in Iowa.
About midway through my junior year at Iowa, I kind of started to shift, and I really liked the nutrition aspect of things and thought that I had a really, a really good opportunity since I had access to a small amount of land to be able to grow whole foods in their whole farm and give them right to the people that were going to eat them. And I thought, when I sat there and looked at my classmates and most of them had come from a larger city. Nobody had access to land like that, and I didn't think they'd have the opportunity to do anything like this. And knowing that people need this whole nutritious food, I figured, why not?
So I take it that, you've done quite a bit of educating your customers about maybe like how to use vegetables or even about what the vegetables are. So what are some of the things you You do. I mean, do you give out recipes, or what are some of the ways you approach that?
Yeah, definitely. So with our CSA especially, we send out a newsletter like many other farms do. And then on our newsletter, besides the farm news and the updates and things like that, we provide, you know, first and foremost, a list of vegetables you're getting that week. And then we pick out a couple vegetables that maybe are a little less common. You know, most people know how to use a tomato, but they might not be as familiar with Swiss chard or turnips or some of those things I mentioned before. So we try and provide recipes as well as storage tips. I actually had a person one time that she came to pick up her share a week later, and she's like, you know, those beets just aren't storing for me. And I was like, well, how are you storing them? She's like, well, I just put them on my kitchen counter. I'm like, oh, okay, well, our beets should actually, you know, be refrigerated. And if properly stored, they can last for many months in your refrigerator. So we after we kind of got a couple things like that, we realized that, you know, not everybody's farmers and not everybody's very used to eating some of these different foods. So we started to provide a lot of storage tips, which helped a lot. We got some really positive feedback about that. And it really helps people figure out how to store things. But the recipes are really good. You know, I kind of default, as I think maybe many other CSA farms do, and it's, if you don't know what to do with it, try a stir fry. And I've also been really heavy on roasting vegetables. We just really enjoy that here on the farm. It's a good way to try new things, and it always seems to come out of the oven pretty good. So I always try and recommend that. And then when we're at farmers markets, we'll do little samples of things here and there. Like this past week at farmers market, I had a sample of some of the salad turnips out, as well as like our radishes, just to give people a little bit of idea what the flavor is going to be like. And and things like turnips, which aren't maybe quite as widely used around here, having those samples and letting people try it really does help promote sales a little bit, as well as letting the customer know what they're getting before they actually spend the money and take it home.
So you mentioned the thing with the beets. What are some of the other things that your customers have learned about how to store your veggies, or I guess some of the common things that maybe a lot of people don't know about veggie storage?
Yeah, I think the thing that people don't realize is how long some things can actually store. So, for example, cabbage, carrots, potatoes, maybe not so much potatoes, but anything that can store quite a while in the cold, like in a cooler or refrigerator, it always seems to amaze people that, you know, when I tell them, you know, if you take the tops off these carrots and, you know, maybe put them in a vented bag and throw them in your refrigerator, you know, you can have carrots in there for months and months if you would like to. So I think that's probably the most the thing that I see the most, where people are so surprised that, you know, cabbages, the right variety, can store for 6 months in the cooler if you're doing everything correctly. So I think that's the kind of the biggest thing. The other thing that I find is our greens store really well in general. So I get a lot of people that they'll have our salad mix, and it'll be going on the third week, and they'll come to farmer's market and say, you know, I got in the refrigerator today and I pulled out your bag of salad mix thinking it was going to be all bad, and it wasn't. So I made myself a salad, and I'm here to get some more today. So I always like to hear that when things store really well. I actually had a customer one time. We grew these, we don't really grow them too much anymore, but they were baby red bell peppers, really small, and she had bought a bunch at the end of the season. Our market season ended in October, and she emailed me in January saying that she got them out of her refrigerator and was eating them because they were still good for her. So some of those storage things, I think amaze a lot of people. And sometimes hearing stories like that with the peppers amazes me even. But every year, I'm more and more surprised by, you know, what a quality walk-in cooler can do as far as helping your produce store a little bit longer, and then being able to eat that stuff through an extended window without actually having to have it out in the field to harvest.
So you're having a field day coming up with Practical Farmers of Iowa, and you're actually going to talk about some of those issues of scaling up and farm machinery and tools and stuff. Could you talk a little bit about that field day that's coming up?
Yeah, so it's I think the title on it was Tractors and Tools with TD. And what I'm going to be kind of talking about is, yeah, all the different pieces of equipment that I've, acquired over the last few years. So when I was first getting started, I was pretty lucky. I grew up on a family farm. So we did have some equipment already, but most of it was way too big for my scale of operation. And then some of it honestly just isn't useful. I don't really need a 12-row corn planter. It's not going to plant beets for me. So some of that stuff was useful, but mostly the only thing I used, we had a small 50-horse tractor that was my grandpa's. And then about 15 years ago, my grandma, we were growing raspberries on a small scale, and she bought about a 70-inch rototiller that goes on the back of a tractor. And when she had bought it, those things were, I think she paid like $800 for it brand new. Obviously, a lot more expensive now. But we've had that, and it only really got used, you know, every once in a while until I came along and started doing this. So I had those two pieces of equipment, which definitely helped a lot. But it wasn't quite what I needed, you know, as far as getting plants in the ground and then being able to weed them. So when we very first started, we had, you know, just those things and added in like a couple things like wheel hoes and things like that. But, you know, honestly, that first year, I didn't even know what a wheel hoe was. So we didn't have one. We were doing everything completely with hand hoes. And then we kind of discovered what a wheel hoe was, and I bought that, and basically that was the start of buying all this different equipment. So since then, we've come a decent ways.
T.D. Hollab of Garden Oasis Farm near Coggin in eastern Iowa. For more information on TD's June 9th field day and other farm events and resources, and to learn more about Practical Farmers of Iowa, check out practicalfarmers.org.
There, thanks to Nick Odie for that Farm Talk report. Our man in the field for the Donalana Kitchen, he brings us information about how food is being grown out there by real people on the real Iowa dirt.
And thanks to PFI for loaning us Nick Odie.
Very good, very good. This is Donalana Kitchen, KHOI 89.1. Thank you.
This is KHOI 89.1. Where are I? I forgot where I was. FM. The Donna Lana Kitchen. And we have a very special interview here today. Someone that we don't hear from very frequently. Lana Noctegal is going to talk about the Central Iowa Barn Dance because Lana, and many of you may not know this, is a dance caller.
Yeah, one of my many hats, I think.
Yeah, and how did you get into doing this, Lana?
Oh, my. Many moons ago, way back in the last century, I discovered that there was something called, well, it's called barn dancing around here, probably because that was used to be the venue when people had time at the end of the day, and after a day of hard work, believe it or not, people used to get together and dance all night.
Is this sort of an Appalachian origin dancing?
Well, believe it or not, barn dancing, clogging, old-time music does have Appalachian roots, which is really odd for this part of the country because it comes from England, it comes from Scotland, there's cowboy music thrown in, there's southern music, banjo music put in, there's Canadian Cajun put in. It all turns out to be American music, but here in the mid-70s, there was a group called the Onion Creek, there still is a group called the Onion Creek Cloggers, but the people that started that were from Appalachia. Their names were Bob and Diane Frederick. But they
lived here in Ames.
They were, as most people, they came here for graduate school. And so they gathered a group around them who liked to play music, shared tunes, and then besides doing music and just doing some clogging steps, which is more of a show-off sort of thing. You could just make music with your feet. They started something called a community dance where the dances are taught and called, and squares and contra dances and circles and reels and all kinds of things. And so I got kind of interested in that.
Yeah, probably Lon is a very, very dancey person.
Oh,
here.
I am. I like dancing, but I had never had this idea of a called dance. I'd heard of square dancing before. The idea of someone kind of teaching you and pushing you through this dance. And what's really nice about community dancing, barn dancing, is you get to, believe it or not, hold hands with your neighbors and dance and circle right, circle left, go up and down the set, swing your neighbor do-si-do, all that kind of stuff. And it's a fine thing to do. I just found it wonderful. I kind of got involved with the group in the late 80s. And
how did you learn to call? Is there a dance caller's school?
Oh, well, actually, there are. You can do that. But I realized, I am an artist. I'm a designer. I noticed there was patterns to this, believe it or not. There were patterns. Things repeated. And one thing I learned, the caller of community dances, the caller of these sort of folk dances, was the person that existed between the band and the dancers. My job was to connect the dancers to the band. Other people were doing it. I learned a lot from listening to other folks. And one thing I learned is that as a dance caller, you have to be 8 beats ahead of the rest of the world.
Ha!
You just have to think about what comes next. So when the downbeat comes, you say, meet your partner, do-si-do. So right after I say do-si-do, it's already in their heads so their feet can hit the ground right when they're supposed to. So being just thinking 8 beats ahead, and it takes practice. And I went to a lot of workshops, and I learned from people here in town. And there's some interesting callers here in town. So I learned from those folks, and I've enjoyed it ever since.
Well, you do weddings and functions, and then most notoriously, the Central Iowa Barn Dance. Tell us about the Central Iowa Barn Dance.
The Central Iowa Barn Dance started just as a group that just wanted to put on community dances. Indian Creek Cloggers are still alive and still kicking and still dancing, and they do that too, but they also do performances of clogging steps, and that kind of stuff is wonderful. But my joy is getting people up out of their lawn chairs and dancing. So I've always enjoyed teaching. And teaching people to dance because I love watching people smile. That started in 1991, believe it or not, Central Iowa Barn Dance. And we just concentrated on dance bands, dance music, always live music. And we've been going at it ever since. Sometimes lots of people come. Sometimes people forget about us for a while and they come back. So it's been going for about 26 years now. And it's been a lot of fun.
And the next one is?
We've been having dances on the fourth Saturday of just about every month. We don't do it in the heat of the summer. We don't do a July dance. We don't do a December dance. But every other month, it's the fourth Saturday. And coming up this Saturday, May 24th, is the Central Iowa Barn Dance.
No, that says May 27th.
Oh, I'm sorry. May 27th. Thank you.
She will be there on the 27th.
Oh, yeah. I better check my calendar. Yes. And this Saturday is going to be kind of interesting. We're going to have the band Melon Farmer. You may be familiar with Billy Kearney. Billy Kearney's a local fiddler. He's a joy to dance to. He'll have some other fine musicians with him, and he calls his band Melon Farmer. Yeah, very good. But also, besides the old-time American squares and New England reel sort of music that he loves to play, I have asked my friend Linda Lieberman to come because she is part of a group that does English country dancing, which is kind of the grandmother of American country dancing. And she'll be calling some older dances. Think of Jane Austen, that sort of dances. Any civilized person would have to know how to do these English country dances.
Does that mean it's a little slower?
It's a little slower, a little more gliding. Yes, a little slower.
For those of us that are novices at this sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's funny. All the moves are very, very similar. But, of course, the English say it one way. We say it the other way. We say do-si-do, means pass your partner back-to-back. They use the term back-to-back, probably because they didn't want to say anything French. I don't know. I say do-si-do. She says back-to-back. And the music is absolutely lovely. English country dance music is very lyrical. And many of the tunes are older, and you'll be able to see that. We're going to kind of be a tag team. I'll call one, she'll call one, I'll call one. So there'll be contras and English country dancing and squares and English country dancing. Kind of a nice mix. I thought it'd be nice to have Linda come and help us celebrate the merry month of May with some English country dancing.
Oh.
She has a group, a small group here in town. They get together and play again, also with live music, and that's a real joy. Sometimes we meet in her house, and she pushes back the furniture and dance there. Actually, that's one thing about this sort of dancing that kind of takes us back to kitchens and barns when people really did empty out the house.
Home entertainment. Entertainment center was not electronic.
Roll up the rug, put the fiddler in the corner, put the caller kind of squashed up next to the fiddler, and you'd call. You'd say, here's what's going to happen, folks. Walk you through the dance. And then you give the fiddler a nudge, and you start. And again, the caller starts, thinks about 8 beats ahead. Okay. We're ready to go, and we dive into it.
So this is the Central Iowa Barn Dance this coming Saturday, May 27th, 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Collegiate Wesley Annex, 130 South Sheldon Avenue. This is in Ames.
Mm-hmm. And you can find out more information at www.cibdcentraliowabarndance.org. Yes.
And by the way, Lana chooses all the music for our show.
I do have a stash of music. Yes, I do.
Yes, and she knows her way around the music scene here.
It may be kind of a special little interest because I really do like music with fiddles and banjos in it. Yeah, I do.
Americana.
Yeah, we've got good tunes here. And the idea of us making our own music, our own entertainment, that's really important. This is folk art. You are the folks, people. Come on and help make it happen. We have some news items here. Donna has a news item. I like this one.
Yes, this is the beer industry. This comes a new report from the beer industry has served up 2.2 million jobs from Americans' love of the malty beverage. So it employs 2.2 million people and contributes $350 billion to the U.S. economy. That's last year.
What?
Yep. The number of brewers in the U.S. has grown from fewer than 50 in 1985 to nearly 5,000 today.
Ha!
That's just a little more than 30 years. Employment among brewers is rising at 9 times the rate of overall U.S. employment. And the number of jobs has increased 24% over the last decade, topping 134,000, with most of the growth in large and medium-sized businesses. I guess that's not our craft brewers, but we've got a few employment options going along here in town with our 3 local brewers. Overall, the beer industry, are you ready for this?
Ah.
Has paid $63 billion in taxes in 2006, or about 41% of the prices consumers pay at retail locations. So, all you beer drinkers, you are contributing to our tax revenues.
Doesn't that just
that
warm your heart?
That is a good American pastime, I guess.
I like that. Again, something that is done, it can be done on a real small scale or ramped up a little bit and
consumed in moderation, of course.
Well, that's fine. Well, actually, I find I can't drink a lot of beer and dance. That doesn't work too well. And it's not really the keeping my wits about me, is that things get kind of squished up in my stomach as I go up and down. But I do not mind a fine beer after I am through.
Well, you would think dancing would also burn off the calories.
Oh, it does. It does.
Beer drinking.
It is absolutely great for, like, watching your girlish figure. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Oh, also another. Now, this is way in the future, but just put this on your calendar.
This is a good one coming up in August.
August 21st. There's going to be a total solar eclipse.
Visible in Iowa, right?
Yeah, we don't get to see the total. We get to see almost just a little bit of it. It's going to go through Nebraska and, kind of like a little south of the pipeline, it looks like. Nebraska and Missouri is going to go through. But people are already making their plans to actually go and stand underneath it. Because, yes, truly, if you are right under the path, it will be dark.
If we have no cloud cover, that
right.
is.
And also coming up in August, KHOI's 5th birthday. Stay tuned.
Oh, boy,
for
oh, boy.
More things, yes. Oh, and the barn dance this Saturday, Central Iowa Barn Dance. So, today we talked about chickweed and other kinds of weed, rhubarb tangine. We got a farm talk by Nick Odie.
Yes. From Practical Farmers of Iowa.
Yes, we did. And we talked about dancing and beer. That pretty much covers it. Thanks to Nick Odie for that farm talk report. We'll go out with some fine dance music. This little piece is called Swamp Haggis. So think of your
Swamp Haggis.
So think of your Scottish delicacy there. The musician, the banjo player, is Sam Bartlett. I've had the pleasure of actually calling to Sam Bartlett.
I saw that at the Pippa Middleton wedding, which was Scotch themed.
Yes, they
had haggis.
Oh, there you Woo-hoo! Go. There you go. Listen to the Donalana Kitchen Tuesday at noon, 7 p.m. Tuesday evening, or any time at KHOIFM.org. It's streamed. It's done all kinds. Use your device. Yes. Thanks for joining us today on the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had fine engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.